orientation.
Thank you very much. I'm loving the despite. There.
Well.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to day two of the Future University. My talk is on the topic of disciplines and disorientation, and because of the time of day it is, I'm the warm-up act. Modern science is a local tradition and is not easily transmitted from one place to another. Countries such as India, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Argentina, Brazil, Egypt, Mexico have built great modern cities with spacious universities, but they have rarely succeeded in founding important schools of research. Here, research work stagnates for lack of stimulus. There, it runs wild in the absence of proper directive influence. Unsound reputations grow like mushrooms, based on nothing but commonplace achievements or even on mere empty boasts. Politics and business play havoc with appointments and the granting of funds for research. Unquote. That was Michael Polanyi, the great anti-communist physical chemist, propagandist, and founder of the Society for Freedom in Science, writing from Manchester in 1951, exactly, 60 years ago last month. He was responding to an equally inflammatory essay by his hereditary enemy, Desmond Bernal, great Stalinist, central planner, crystallographer, and general sage, who had returned from India at the beginning of 1950 after attending a meeting in Mumbai of the Indian Academy of Sciences, talking at great length with eminent Indian scientists, including C.V. Raman and G.N. Ramachandran, great crystal scientist, molecular biologist, and the Indian general, Daita Ram Thapa, father of the much more famous Romila Thapa. The most important of Bernal's apparent exchanges were those with the new prime minister of a newly independent India, Nehru. And in the debates with Nehru, Bernal and the prime minister charted as best they could, and according to Bernal, in a most unsatisfactory way, the future university, as it would be in India, his phrase. So the theme of the future university is old. And although our friend Nigel Thrift will tell us after the break that critique is necessary but not sufficient, what I want to insist on here is that critique is necessary. I follow, as usual, religiously the instructions of Professor Jacobus. Our concern is not the future of the university, otherwise, presumably, given where this meeting is taking place, it could barely extend over 3 days. Rather, the theme is the future university. One needs, it seems to me, to identify the function of that term, especially in current discourses and the origins of current discourses on, for example, further education and its institutions. And a number of conjectures might immediately occur to one in the wake of the long history, which includes exchanges such as those between Polanyi, denying that the future university is Eastern, and Bernal, asserting that it must be. One's first conjecture, then, is that in the use of the term, there is a systematic relation between the way the term is used and a certain kind of politico-economic geography. And we'll hear more about that, I imagine, tomorrow from Debjani Ganguly and her colleagues on the very notion of the creation of the global and the world. We're told too that, and I quote from the brief, post-disciplinary developments along with policy implications are to be considered when it comes to rethinking the very basis of the future university. So there's a second theme which is striking in the usage of the term, the very notion of disciplinarity and its cognates. We might then identify quickly a number of features of the language that speaks of the idiom in which the term finds its place. First, and this is clearly a paradox, around the notion of discipline. The future university, one is supposed to imagine, will be ferociously disciplined by the market. And it will be ferociously undisciplined because it will live in a, choose your term, multi-trans or inter- or post-disciplinary world. The second paradox is, as I've already indicated, geographical. Because of something called digitality, about which we'll hear a great deal, I'm delighted to say, the university will be highly distributed geographically. Yet at the same time, it will above all else be elsewhere. It will not be here. In each of those moves, an implied and very significant contrast is made between an imagined recent past and a projected visionary future. That's how the unlikely couple, future and university, is forged. Let me begin by reflecting on some aspects of the geography. And although he's not with us at the just yet, I want to cite a passage from Nigel Thrift that I find absolutely admirable. I quote from him. There is a rare Beatles demo. It's the sort of thing Nigel knows about, really. There's a rare Beatles demo recorded by John Lennon after the Beatles' trip to India in 1968 called India, India. Great lyricist, right? It manages to encompass many of the post-imperial longings that the British have had for India. Nigel continues, it would be entirely possible to see the visit, where last autumn, by five British government ministers who are travelling to India, including the Prime Minister, the Business Secretary, and the Minister of State for Universities, David Willetts, as, I quote again, a kind of reprise. Well, yes, indeed, last autumn, in November of 2010, David Willetts and his colleagues did indeed visit India and signed a number of absolutely crucial agreements between the British and the Indian governments around precisely the future university. Their declaration includes the statement that links between the UK and India are strong and long-standing, and the rapid expansion of scientific and research collaboration between the UK and India is helping to find solutions to global and local problems. Thus, David Willetts and the Indian minister, Kapil Sibal. Now, it's very interesting to reflect both on the language and the direction of these kinds of agreements, especially during the passage into law of a series of pieces of Indian legislation around foreign university and foreign educational corporate investment inwardly into India and the implications and planning dilemmas that that has raised. Similarly, it's interesting to reflect on British and above all current British ministerial responses to those dilemmas and initiatives. This is Mr. Willetts, quote, I was staggered when I first learnt that India plans to create 40 million new university places and train 500 million people in vocational skills over the next 12 years, unquote. I'm sure he was. Now, particularly striking, as many of you will know, in this kind of language is indeed, as Nigel points out, a certain kind of orientalism that's in play, a contrast between a site that belongs to the future and a site that belongs to the past. But the future is radically displaced, roughly speaking, to the east, and the past, the site of tradition and of antiquity, is radically displaced to the northwest. This, I think, gives the language of the future university its fascinatingly complex, or some aspects of its fascinatingly complex, set of functions. As one surveys a whole series of discussions around the notion of the future university that have been conducted over the past 10 to 15 years, many of them, perhaps a surprisingly large number of them, have this feature. As, for example, a meeting at the Globalization Research Center in 2002, where a really important paper by one of its members, Jayashree Odin, argued that, and I quote, "the modern university has operated on the same model for about two centuries with a certain organizational structure, typical administrative and teaching learning practices, and a given conception of knowledge. Secondly, and I quote, the use of new technologies is finally leading to new directions in higher learning. Thirdly, that the hyperlinked nature of the internet will allow, and I quote, a promotion of interdisciplinarity as well as intercultural inquiry. And finally, as Odin, I think, rightly urges, this must of necessity reorient, if not disorient, a familiar geography of global university systems, culture, and economy." Now, those kinds of themes are repeated over and over again in this sort of discourse. They are, for example, absolutely the stock in trade of developed countries, the US, Europe, and so on, initiatives in establishing bases within the subcontinent. One can look, for example, at a recent report by the University of Chicago's Ad Hoc Committee on India, produced last year, chaired by Deepesh Chakrabarty, with Martha Nussbaum and others as members. On the basis of the Obama-Singh 21st Century Knowledge Initiative, a commitment is made to provide $10 million in combined funding to increase university linkages and support junior faculty development between American and Indian universities. And in particular, so the report has it, the focus is on interdisciplinary research projects, thus the report. Our university has always combined a commitment to scholarly excellence in the individual disciplines with an equally firm commitment to cooperation, not extra disciplinary, but genuinely interdisciplinary. To give just one example, the report continues, of what was once a fairly widespread trend in the subcontinent, Rabindranath Tagore's Santi Niketan School and Vishwabharati University in West Bengal pioneered bold experiments that combined humanities, social sciences, and the arts. References too to the Tata Institute of Social Sciences in Mumbai and the Institute of Economic Growth in New Delhi, where collaboration, cross-disciplinary and interdisciplinary in the social sciences, are much in evidence. In other words, there is a systematic, repeated link in these discourses between a very particular kind of orientalism and a very particular kind of interdisciplinarity. and I think it's interesting to reflect on what the relation between those two tropes could be and why the notion of the future university relies on both of them simultaneously and so often. Now, from within my own field, despite being an historian of science, the prompt here is probably, I'm guessing, but I have evidence that this is so, the now very well-known collective work, The New Production of Knowledge, produced by Gibbons, Limoges, Novotny, Schwarzman and others, roughly a decade ago. That work imagined a supersession of what was called Mode One knowledge, a hegemony of disciplinary science with its strong sense of an internal hierarchy between the disciplines and driven by the autonomy of scientists and their host institutions, the universities, by something they called Mode Two, socially distributed, application-oriented, transdisciplinary, and subject to multiple accountabilities. In her reflections on the reception of this account, Helga recalls that those with most to gain from this story liked it a lot. They were, surprise, politicians, civil servants, management specialists, and the staffs of new universities. Those with most to lose loathed it, established disciplinary practitioners in particular, guilty as charged. How to specify mode two? There were five criteria. Knowledge is made in application, it's transdisciplinary, it's made at many sites, it reflects on its own mode of knowing, it's audited, yet it's very hard to audit. One found the mode's traces in the commercialization of research, in mass higher education, in applied humanities, and in audit culture. And they made some predictions. Planning would get harder, self-organization more common, futures markets would dominate, space-time categories, this is the thing that interests me, space-time categories would shift. Now, one standard response from the historian of the sciences and of the institutions of knowledge in particular is, of course, that nothing's new here. Early modern and high capitalist universities were absolutely characterized by knowledge made in contexts of application. Their disciplines were fluid. Sorry, I'm starting to sound too Dickensian, so I'll slow down. Knowledge was made in contexts of application. Disciplines were fluid. Work took place across many social sites. There was strikingly pervasive reflection on the grounds of knowledge in the process of making knowledge. And of course, it was simultaneously necessary and difficult to assess knowledge quality in systems of distributed and mutable trust and credit. So mode two has always been with us. And secondly, mode one, recall that sclerotic world of disciplinary science with its strong sense of an internal hierarchy driven by the autonomy of scientists and their host institutions, the university, that mode is in fact also, and I think mainly, and perhaps even only, an ideological trope for knowledge brokers themselves seeking to sacralize their work by defining its stoic withdrawal. And the efficacy of their work within the universities is always an aspect of their impurity. So it's for that reason, it seems to me, that if we are to have a grown-up conversation about the future university, we have at least to begin with a reflection on this imaginary set of histories of disciplinarity and where they came from and what they're for. So within the university, every discipline tells a story. It tells a story about where it comes from and what it is and where it's going. Disciples learn these parables as part of their induction. The story gives an account of the origin and course of disciplinary development. It provides a rationale and a means for the pursuit of the disciplinary enterprise. Discipline's stories are therefore performatives. They make what they pretend merely to announce. Their stories, simultaneously mnemonic and monitory role, depends on a particular genealogy of modern disciplinarity, and that becomes particularly telling in the face of an expansive discourse of interdisciplinarity. As our colleague Alan New has very well remarked 2 decades ago and more, interdisciplinarity is, and I quote from Alan, the most seriously underthought critical, pedagogical, and institutional concept in the modern academy, and that is surely still true. Proclamations of the imminence and desirability of interdisciplinary inquiry, in other words, the identification of the future university with something like interdisciplinarity, also always appeals to disciplinary histories. This version of the future as ideology supports and relies on an image of long-standing disciplinarity in the process of welcome, if painful, transformation. And the ideology, evidently, if oddly, takes as accurate histories the stories disciplines have told about themselves. That's how interdisciplinarity acquires its own disciplinarity, its own disciplinary history, and its own notion of the future. So the discourse of the future as interdisciplinary identifies itself with innovative, flexible responses to ever more complex realities. The claim that the established order must now at last, and the at last is very important here, be overhauled is often accompanied by the touching remark that this claim is quite new, that one's never heard it before, that at last one sees how things are, and that at last some clarity can be introduced into these undisciplined projects. One is regularly told that the situation is now to be corrected. Projects for interdisciplines produce histories and predictions that suppose prior disciplinary power and homogeneity. In his celebrated analysis of the movement of theories between sites of production and reinterpretation, Edward Said wrote that, quote, "The distinction between one discipline and another has been blurred precisely because fields are no longer considered to be as all-encompassing or as synoptic as," and this is the crucial phrase, "until recently they once were." So interdisciplinary talk summons into existence a memory of a past hegemony now to be overthrown. If, as the philosophers of the fin de siècle notoriously argued, truths are dead metaphors and scientific instruments are boxed experiments about which one has forgotten that this is what they are, then disciplines, in my view, are interdisciplines about which the same kind of amnesia has occurred. So it's claimed then that once upon a time there was a hegemony, an imperium, which will now be displaced by movements elsewhere, by geographical, technical, and epistemic forms of reorganization. But again, as an historian, one has to insist on the fact that the primeval world of disciplinary hegemony has never been easy to find, or analyze, or map. Throughout the last century, it seemed important, to be sure, to maintain certain boundaries between pure and applied knowledge, between the sciences and society. between the universities and others, between experts and the laity. But at the same time, the permeability of these boundaries was also stressed. Pure sciences were to be applied to human purposes, hinged on the conditions of social order, and would thus help integrate lay and expert understandings. Though the secluded laboratory became unevenly, painfully, and in strange ways, a dominant model of intellectual work, museums and gardens and libraries and zoos and field stations all remained just as vital sites as they'd been in previous epochs. While the label science, for example, was but rarely allowed for systems of ethics or morals, the social and the human sciences were widely cultivated, and new expertise, as the century ended, in areas such as sports science or food science, burgeoned. The task of situating licensed experts and their forms of knowledge was carried on in a vast, heterogeneous range of milieu, not even mainly universities, but elsewhere. This range of milieu helped define the scope of legitimate knowledges and their meanings, their relation with everyday life, the claims of capital, and the range of human purposes. And very rarefied or apparently rarefied issues, such as the distinction between natural sciences and technology, or the link between expert knowledge and practical reason, were distributed right across this landscape. A very important theme here was the tension, which I think dominates the models of the future university that are available to us, between the notion that expert knowledge in general and scientific knowledge in particular is a special kind of attitude requiring a special psychic, epistemic, or methodological approach, and the notion that, in Huxley's terms, it's organized common sense. A contemporary apostle of the common sense of science was the eminent British embryologist and founder of the Science Studies Unit in Edinburgh, C.H. Waddington, who wrote, "Science is largely common sense. When people discover what science is, they find it something they have known all along." That was an old theme that the discourse of the future university gives new salience. Speaking to large audiences in wartime Britain, Hal Waddington lectured that the way to get results is this kind of application, and in a planned society based on socialism, Darwinism, and engineering, a Bernalist society, in other words, social progress would be unlimited. With very different political implications, these were common arguments throughout the decades of innumerable programs in such countries as Japan, which during the 1980s, partly through its huge private overseas investments in Europe and the Americas, became one of the world's major supporters of university-based and industry-based research. Or, of course, Brazil, which by that decade had more than 250 scientists per million of population. An analyst of the new Japanese Technopolis explained in 1986 that, quote, "a romanticized notion of the rugged individual, the lone scientific inventor, must give way to the more pragmatic reality that is coming in the future of large corporate research and development teams conducting joint research. Such accounts were promoted by state, by academy, and by industry to underline the worth of wide diffusion globally in the name of something like economic development." That is the precise context in which the exchange between Polanyi and Bernal, with which I began, needs to be set. Hard though it might now be to recall, a significant problem over the last 6 to 7 decades has been not, as it might be, the transplantation, God help us, of the university model to other countries in a kind of Podsnapian way, but rather different kinds of explanations of the failure of the university model to be adopted elsewhere. Because the knowledges made in universities were universal, the clue is in the name. The task of states and corporations had been taken to be an insurance of the resource base. As Ed Schiltz put it in 1968, and I quote from the great man, "All policy can do is to influence the working of this autonomous system through decisions that grant or withhold financial resources, provide an appropriate administrative context, supply manpower, or set certain tasks. Once these are done," Schiltz continued, "the autonomously systematic properties of scholarship must be allowed to manifest themselves," unquote. By the mid-1960s, if not earlier, as Kapil Raj has pointed out in a very interesting analysis, this task looked to those people as though it had failed. A magnificently interesting example of this reflection is a remarkable essay written by the brilliant astrophysicist Arnab Rai Chowdhury, a graduate of presidency and the Kanpur Institute of Technology, now professor of astronomy and astrophysics at IIT in Bangalore, but then a PhD student in Chicago in the mid-1980s, and then auditing the courses in historiography of the sciences and sociology of science offered by Professor Richards and his colleagues in dialogue with Robert Merton and with Joseph Ben-David. Chowdhury reflected on what he called the problem of Indian science. His question was, what went wrong with Indian science? Why have our institutions failed to reach the standard of the best Western institutes? His reflections, I think, give us much meat for thinking about the very notion of the future university. They were written in the immediate context of the attack on the Golden Temple in Amritsar and the assassination of the Indian Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, yet they close with a magnificently optimistic and, in fact, rather accurate characterization of Indian university takeoff. The characterization is slightly mitigated. "I would not venture to guess whether India is really on the threshold of a scientific golden age or whether we are just being fooled by the rays of a false dawn," he writes in 1985. But I think at least as interesting for our reflections are the diagnoses he offers of the problem, as he saw it then, of Indian universities in general and the sciences in particular. Three aspects seem striking to me in retrospect about Chowdhury's essay. First, he reverses what was then the absolutely standard model of easy implantation. It was widely assumed that culture, and above all humanistic culture, was hard to get to travel, techno-science easy. He argued the opposite was the case and prayed in evidence the fact that the Bengal Renaissance of the early 20th century showed how easy it had been for Bengali intelligentsia to absorb Western literary and humane culture, while the problem of the efficient implantation of the natural sciences in Indian universities, so he argued, had been recalcitrant indeed. Secondly, he adopted the language of what I've called the future university, that after the Second World War, the sciences became big business, they became multidisciplinary, they became commercially oriented, money and communication became overwhelmingly important, and he made the consequential distinction between what he called partial, that's to say tradition-bound, and total, that's to say research-oriented institutions. And finally, he drew a ferocious contrast between the work of academic research and teaching on the one hand and the work of institution building and political and economic planning on the other. He gave, for example, an extraordinary account of the career of one of the very greatest Indian scientists of the 20th century, Meghnad Saha, whom he judged had failed in the end, precisely because Saha had switched out of research into institution building. I quote from Chowdhury's characterization of Saha, "He had eaten the fruit of knowledge now that he had seen conditions in Western universities, and he knew how uneven the competition was for him." That was the explanation of his move into political programming. Now, I hold no brief for those arguments, but as symptoms, it seems to me, they are extremely consequential if we are to reflect on the ways in which a certain kind of political geography of Orientalism and a certain kind of disciplinary geography of post or interdisciplinarity is to be in play in our arguments about and our models of the future university. I've tried to suggest here that the complexity of the relation between those two moves is partly given by those two false gods, amnesia and nostalgia, a certain forgetting of the long histories of multi and interdisciplinarity within the university institution over the centuries, and a nostalgia at the same time about that imagined past. There's a twist in my tale, however. I also want to insist on the fact that the very notion of implantation, of transplantation, which is in play in so much discourse on the future university, must be at least complemented and perhaps replaced by a historiography and a critique which moves in exactly the opposite direction, which remembers and which never allows our masters and our funders to forget that much of what we take, much of what some of us take to be tradition, to be the Western university, to be the developed model, of course, comes from the East, from engagements with the East and complicated negotiations with its implications. To paraphrase scholars of Orientalism, the metropole is not just to be provincialized, but to be understood as itself overtaken by its own colonial interests. I don't have time now to detail this. Suffice it to say that from the very origins, for example, of Benthamite panoptic models of discipline, which were in fact imported into Britain from Madras, not the other way round, to a much more consequential example, which is the experiences of Beatrice Webb and R.H. Tawney in Jamshedpur in the early 20th century, and the absorption within institutions like the LSE of Indian models of welfare and social development under the patronage of the Ratan Tata Foundation. Examples could be multiplied of the way in which the models we take to be European traditions are always already developed in the very context of these cross-national, international, and cross-disciplinary exchanges. Indeed, it's surely no coincidence, finally, that Orientalism itself, as a disciplinary form, has been marked by an intense attention to these puzzles of geography and interdisciplinarity. It seemed as if such systems should best be seen not only as tools of imperial rule, but as imperial forms in their own right. Said once powerfully appealed for what he called greater interventionism in cross-disciplinary activity as part of a clarified political and methodological commitment to the dismantling of systems of domination. The frequency with which the very notion of discipline as a form of knowledge has thus been directly associated with the illegitimacies and violences of colonial or imperial rule hints precisely how the discourse of interdisciplinarity, on the one hand, urges its subversive, its future-oriented potency, and simultaneously how imagined disciplinary histories can be treated as simple accounts of the hegemonic exercises of power. Nigel Thrift is absolutely right. Thank you.